Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today, I feel blessed because I have one of my favorite people back on to speak with us today. We're going to speak with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. As people know a lot about her, she's one of the voices, the original voices of healthcare, of what it really means to be a doctor. Without all of the things that have come to pass in the last 15, 20 years, we're going to talk about medicine the way it used to be, the way it's supposed to be, and I think still is, but patients need to, and doctors need to understand that there's a parallel path, and we're going to speak about that today. So a little bit about Dr. Singleton. She's a native Californian and physician. She went from Southeast San Diego, where despite being told they don't take Negroes at Stanford, she graduated from Stanford and went to UCSF Medical School. She then completed 2 years of surgery residency at UCSF, then her anesthesia residency at Harvard's Beth Israel Hospital. After completing her residency, she became an instructor, then assistant professor of anesthesiology and critical care medicine at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. Upon returning to California, she worked at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. She returned to Oakland and practiced at Alta Bates Hospital. While working at the hospital, she attended UC Berkeley Law School, focusing on constitutional law and administrative law. She interned at the National Health Law Project and practiced insurance and health law. In 2012, she ran for Congress with a message of personal freedom and limited government. She's also the past president of the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons. Dr. Singleton, I really know how busy you are, and I'm really just blessed to have you back on today. And thank you once again for joining me.
Well, thank you. It is always a pleasure to talk with you and be on the show.
Well, I think we need to have one of these old-fashioned conversations about our healthcare system. It has changed dramatically in the past 3 years, I think, from when I graduated and from when you graduated from medical school and practiced.
Well, first, when I graduated, I think doctors were still going around in a horse and carriage, but do go on, Dr. George.
Hardly, but let's just put it this way. It's when medicine was medicine, when it was about helping people, when it was an individual practice between a doctor and a patient in a room. Now that's completely changed to becoming, I don't know, what do you want to say, algorithm-driven? I don't know. It's just not about privacy or personal choices and patient choices and doctor and patient decisions. It's gone. But what's your concept of that? Am I correct in thinking that it's been corporatized to the nines?
You certainly are. And I think, you know, we have to look at it as some sort of continuum and a path of going down to where medicine has become. And it certainly started with insurance being introduced back in the 40s when they wouldn't raise salaries and wages. And so giving health insurance was a benefit that was done in lieu of raising people's salary. And so people got very used to the idea of health insurance, and that changed the landscape of even a doctor-patient financial relationship. Which, as we know, and I think about a book I read years ago called Money and the Meaning in Life, where they were talking about the positive aspects of actually giving a fair exchange for services, that it does something to you on the inside. And when we don't have that exchange because insurance has taken that over, that eliminated that little psychological thing. And then we started getting fewer and fewer insurance companies. Probably 1980s, there were 800 healthcare products out there, insurance products. And now we've got 4 major insurers that control all the products. So we all know what that's like when you eliminate the competition, the prices go up and people feel trapped. So we have that whole insurance thing. And then we've got these big healthcare systems that at first it kind of seemed like a good idea. You have a big system, and so you've got tons of doctors at your disposal, and you can go down the hall and see the ear, nose, and throat doctor when you left your internist's office. It sounded real good. But as this practice has gone on, we find that patients are being seen for less and less time. 7 to 10 minute visits have become normalized, and patients expect that now, so they accept it. And we'll have to talk about how we tell patients that don't accept it. And so that has changed the face. And I'm blathering on, but I'll go again. Now we even have a big lawsuit because a couple of the big health insurers, it's discovered they had algorithms for deciding how long people should stay in rehab. And of course, we notice it's old folks and the disabled that are the first to take the hit. So now, I've talked too much. Your turn.
You said a very good platform or foundation for our conversation, actually. I mean, you talked about the healthcare side, the insurance side. The hospitals did the same thing, where there were, in New York, for example, literally dozens of hospitals when I was medical school. Each one served a different population. Each one had a different feel or, you know, bent to what they did. Now they've been Pac-Man'd, and I think it's basically maybe two, maybe three systems in the city. But, you know, all this to be said, bigger is not better. It's been apparent to me that it's just lowered the floor, and the lowest common denominator is low. It's like limbo. How low can you go in terms of delivering care? And it's not good. You don't want medicine to be like limbo, right? It's not a good thing when they start cutting corners and buying cheaper medical supplies. I can speak for the OR where the sutures changed and they were tearing as you were trying to, you know, put a stitch in somebody. So I think it's not about how cheap it is. It's about the quality. And it became not about the quality anymore. While they were telling you things about patient rights and patient care, it actually became the opposite, in my opinion.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And you talk about the OR. We had the same thing happen with anesthetic drugs where somebody's deciding, well, this does the same thing. And I'm thinking some of these drugs, no, they don't do the same thing. Yeah, they all will put you to sleep. So we'll big hammer to the head and it's cheaper, but that doesn't mean we have to use it. There's a reason newer things came out, just like when they created newer materials for the sutures, that it's because they were better. And maybe in some patients, it doesn't matter, but in other patients, it does. And that's up to the doctor to decide, not the pharmacy committee, not the hospital committee. That these days, they seem to have fewer and fewer of the people who are actually using the materials or giving the drugs be the decision makers. Who knows who these people are who are on these committees? And they certainly aren't doctor run anymore.
No, I would absolutely agree with that. You're the last person. They just changed things out. No conversation. And it came down to, I'm not coming to this OR anymore. I'm not doing it. You know, that doctors had to get to that level for them to reverse course. And, you know, we have to all take responsibility, don't we? Whether we're doctors or patients, it wouldn't have gotten this far if somebody had stood up. Enough people, because I think we did, but the average doctor, the average patient stood up and said, I'm not doing this. I want better care. I want to deliver better care. I'm worth more than this, whether it's the patient or the doctor, because we've had this middleman just inserted between the doctor and the patient, whether it's the insurance company middleman or the hospital administrator or the government, really, who've now become the arbiter of what constitutes quality care. What constitutes necessary care has nothing to do with the specialty departments anymore, the organizations. It's coming from a different source. So for someone to tell me as an ENT, what are the parameters that I should use to perform a sinus surgery? And they're outrageous. I mean, you have to be on antibiotics for 6 months in a row. You have to be miserable, just destitute medically before they'll approve a case. That's unacceptable, don't you think?
Absolutely. And there, I had an episode when I was at a hospital where I was working, where one of the nurses had had vaginal bleeding, and they said, yeah, you've got uterine fibroids, but your blood count has to be below X before we'll approve getting your fibroids removed. Well, the poor girl passed out at work and was having a massive bleed. Well, gee, when we had to throw her on the operating table and do emergency surgery, magically it's time to approve. We don't want patients to get to that point. And it seems antithetical to, on one side of their mouth, they talk about preventive care and, oh, we want to take care of patients and we're going to pay for mammograms and we're going to do this and we're going to pay for that. But when the chips are down, that's all fake. It's not really real. There's episodes, and you can tell by the way Medicare and the government programs and the insurance programs pay for these things. Like, okay, the colonoscopy is free, but if they find something during the colonoscopy, it would be bad medicine if the surgeon didn't remove the polyp or whatever it was that they found right there. Why put the patient under anesthesia, which some people get anesthesia, at least light anesthesia for colonoscopies, or just the trauma of getting a colonoscopy? Who wants to do that twice? But the patient then wakes up and has a bill for something they thought was free. There was an article about a woman, and it wasn't a huge amount of money, but it was the principle of the thing, and she fought back, where in her wellness visit, the doctor asked about, are you feeling depressed? Because that's one of the check-the-box questions you're supposed to ask. And presumably she said, yeah, and then wanted to chat about it a bit. Well, she got a bill for several hundred dollars for the chat about the depression. Well, why ask right when the patient reveals that you're supposed to be able to say a few words, and it's not like she had a full hour psychotherapy session or something? So this is where all this stuff is kind of phony baloney, that it sounds good, but the reality is not.
That's a great question. I mean, a great point. And, you know, we're going to, I'm sure, talk about telemedicine at some point, but it reminds me of that addition to our health system. It's not at all about really seeing the patient, examining the patient, which is the crux of diagnosis. It's just 15 minutes, maybe, if you're lucky, and a prescription written, sight unseen, body untouched. That doesn't even make sense to me. But this is this virtual movement towards virtual medicine and robotic medicine. Just seems to me that it's all about making a diagnosis and putting someone on a medication, but not necessarily getting to the root of the problem and fixing it so the person can leave the system.
Well, you said it when you talked about getting to the root of the problem. And guess what? Getting to the root of the problem takes time. I can't tell you how many times, and psychiatrists say this all the time, you get the most information in the last 5 minutes of the interview. Mm-hmm. And when I was doing some pain management, you know, you'd really want to know what the patient's life was like and what was going on. And I can't tell you how many times that X, Y, or Z happened after my husband died, or when my dog died, or there was some other life event. Well, if you don't have time to talk to the patient, you're never going to hear about that life event and then explore what it is that especially with pain, that's a trigger. And that's what you have to get to, is the trigger, and not just write a script for something to take away the end result of the trigger.
That's exactly right. I don't think pain is the only thing. There's other diseases. It seems to me that, well, the mind and body are connected, and a lot of things that are unresolved show up in various systems of, you know, organ systems. But you do need time. I remember in medical school, we were taught, and I'm sure you're the same, you know, you make your diagnosis from the history. The diagnosis and the exam is a confirmation of what differential you came up with after asking enough questions to get to know what the heck was going on. And you know, from the education side, I'm not teaching medical students, but they seem to have a different bent. It's not so much on history taking as it is following a tree, a decision tree, and but not really understanding critically, to think out, so you don't need the decision tree.
Well, I look at that, it's like part of the calculator generation. When I was, I'll talk about dating oneself, when I was in college taking physics, I had never learned to use a slide rule. And that's, we could bring a slide rule to class to get the answer. And I told the teacher, you know, I'm sorry, but I never learned to use a slide rule. Despite having two of them, I just never got the hang of it. And mm-hmm. he said, that's okay. Just set up the problem. It's the setup that's important. Now we've seen to go the opposite end, that it's not the setup, it's the answer. And if you know the setup, ultimately you could get the answer. Even if we had to be like the ladies in Hidden Figures for NASA, where you multiplied everything out by hand, it is doable if you know what you're doing.
That's the peace of mind side of it. You go back to, well, you know, I learned this. I've got a brain. I can figure this out. I know enough information that I can pull pieces together to come up with an answer. And it gives you comfort. I don't know how people practice medicine without anxiety at this point from what they, maybe they don't know what they don't know. And so therefore they're not having anxiety. I don't know. But it seems that there's a lot of people out there on the front line who are not as, don't have a depth of knowledge. It's kind of a surface knowledge. And then you use the internet to try to piece it together. You can't do that on the fly when there's an emergency, right? Or an impending emergency. You don't have time to go look it up on Google.
Well, it's funny because part of this all feeds into evidence-based medicine and mm-hmm. guidelines, which, not to knock the idea that you want evidence that something may work or not work, but even evidence-based medicine is not infallible. There can be big mistakes, and there have been big mistakes in the past. And many times a doctor's gut feeling of, you know, this just doesn't seem right. I don't care that they said you could give 100 milligrams or whatever. That just doesn't seem to work right with the patient or a procedure or something. And part of the gut feeling is because you've done it a million times and you don't care what they say, because half the time, the people who are coming up with these guidelines, and again, I'm sure they're very smart people, but many haven't laid eyes on a patient, that they've derived this from literature they've read. And boy, talk about a whole nother tangent. More and more people are starting to question the literature, that they're special interest driven. So how can you believe that things, studies that were funded by the people whose conclusion comes up, yes, and you use our drug, your patient will survive.
Well, let's take our first break, because I want to delve into that, because I think that is one of the underpinnings of why people should question everything now. So let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton, and you can go to her website. She has a podcast, and you can get everything on MarilynSingletonMDJD.com. And they can get your links for your, can they, for your podcast as well?
Yes. And what I do with that, there's a media link where you just link that, and that I have all the podcasts listed. But I also include on the featured, right on the first page, whatever last week's or the last couple of weeks' podcasts were, with a little article about them. So either way, you can listen to the podcast.
Now, before the break, we were talking about the academic side of this and evidence-based medicine. And I want to draw a distinction. There's evidence-based medicine, and I think it's contra to clinical medicine, where people are on the front line seeing their patients, learning from the outcomes of the patient on a day-to-day basis. And that fund of knowledge that you acquire over the course of your medical practice, and that's why it's called a practice, I think that really overrides the evidence-based medicine side of it. Clinical versus some sterile academic setting, which is rife with politics and is underwritten by corporate interests. I mean, who stands to gain? I don't have a gain, but if I find out that I can treat you with an antibiotic flush, a nasal wash, versus putting you on 6 weeks of an antibiotic by mouth. I've learned that over the course of my career, but that's not what's out there in academic medicine. The answer always seems to be a prescription. Nothing natural, nothing preventative. It always seems to be, take this pill for as long as we can get you to, lifelong if we can, and that's the standard of care. Is there a difference, in your opinion, between that style of medicine, which leads to basically medicating a problem, versus clinical, where you're working out problems and getting solutions as part of your practice? Otherwise, you wouldn't stay open.
Well, what's interesting about that, again, we come back to doctor time, that it takes time to work with a patient and be able to say, well, why don't we start off soft and do X, Y, or Z, you know, nasal sprays, whatever it might be, external creams. So many times external creams end up working, and it's been shown working as well as internally taken pills, and that's with NSAIDs, and that's why Voltaren does so well. It's absorbed very well. And work with patients that way. But it takes time because they've got to come back or communicate with you in some way. Well, that didn't work. It's been a month, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you have to have a good enough relationship with the patient where they'll work with you. I mean, patients have been kind of trained to want a quick fix. And if you can't offer the quick fix, well, then forget you. I'll find somebody who I'll sit with for 10 minutes and they'll write me a script. And part of that is the training. It's the training from the ads on TV. And I always say this because it makes me so mad when I see these ads for people. Now they have quite obese people dancing around and buying new clothes, frolicking. People who are clinically depressed or suddenly happy, having picnics with their family and strangers with grins on their faces. These drugs don't work that well. It's like, sorry, Charlie. And anybody out there on them knows that that's true. But these ads have convinced people that they do. And obviously that those tiny, tiny prints at the bottom of the ads that let you know they don't work on everybody that way. You know, nobody reads that. So they walk into the doctor's office expecting that kind of result. So drugs end up being the first line of treatment when they don't always have to be. But so part of working with kind of, we'll call it the old style medicine of working with patients, is you've got to get the patient to buy into that too.
In my opinion, they don't have to, it's our job to educate them, not to have them buy in. There's not a patient, I don't know, I'm probably speaking for myself here, that comes into my office and says, I want X drug, that walks out with X drug. That's not going to happen. We're going to have a conversation. You know, go to somebody else because this is not going to happen here. But let's take a step back. These newer drugs, you just described a lot of commercials that we see every night on TV, but I'm noticing a difference in the side effect profile. Lymphoma, death. That's a side effect for something that is should be medically managed. Is that different? I mean, I don't remember having death as a side effect that they say out loud, and other cancers, that taking this thing when you could probably manage it a different way is the standard of care. Am I wrong, or is this new? It's not
well, new. It's hard to know, Dr. George, because we've got so many other ways to communicate, and there didn't used to be these kinds of ads on TV. And I mean, you can argue that they're useful, it alerts patients to things, but people don't want to see these side effects. And who knows, maybe death, well, death is, can be a side effect of almost anything if you take enough of it or use it improperly. But
these are used properly. This is part
well,
of the
I know. Well, that's
using it properly.
That's the worst is now we have it when even when it's used properly. And it, who knows? I mean, I'm not a chemist. I'm not a research scientist. But many of these things come up because they get more and more specific and they alter cells in a more and more precise way. But it also means that if you're altering things at a deep cellular level, maybe they get altered, quote unquote, too much. I mean, we know cancer and how cancer works, and that many times cancer is latent in your body and you just need some sort of change to have it come out. And now we have viral theories of cancer. So there's so many things that change our cells. And you wonder, the more precise the medicines get, and the more they change our cells, maybe it makes us more susceptible. Again, I don't know. Qualify. I'm not a research scientist. Mm-hmm. But you have to sit down and think these things through and decide, are the side effects worth it? And I think if you have an honest conversation with a patient, and again, so much depends on the patient's circumstances. Obviously, if somebody's tried everything and they're hanging on by a thread, you're going to give them something different. Then you have somebody who walked in with some light symptoms and you say, well, let's start this way. And as long as you know that the disease or the condition that you're treating will not rapidly advance if untreated, then take your time.
I couldn't have said it better. And we have a little bit of a dovetail in sleep apnea and obesity in the ENT section. And I've just seen a throng of people come through where they're on the newest medicine, the newest injectable. And I always ask, I'm like, have you ever tried thinking about going to a nutritionist? That is never an answer. It was never offered. I mean, it just seems that the style of medicine is just changed. They fixed the problem, folks. They didn't just end up with type 2 diabetes because of nothing. It's because of what you're eating, and maybe you need help to change that, as opposed to taking the fast fix with whatever new drug is probably going to be recalled in the next several years. I mean, I don't want to be the guinea pig for that. You know, so, I mean, again, it comes down to personal responsibility, doesn't it? As much as the doctor and the patient.
Yeah, and to a large degree, I mean, we've helped make patients lazy, and we've become lazy. Everybody's become lazy. We've become lazy about a lot of things. And I guess it's time for all of us to say, let's buck up. You know, it's like the whole diet. And now they've discovered different metabolic pathways of obesity, and that everything isn't all about just eating less. But what they discover, because they've discovered the metabolic pathways, that it's what you eat. And there's a reason when recently they did this whole thing of what's the fattest state in the country and what's the thinnest state and all that. A lot of the rural areas had high obesity levels. Why? Because they didn't have access to fresh food. I mean, the dollar stores are everywhere, and that's where folks, even who live out in the country, can get food. And so we have to kind of look at the patient's circumstance and really try to help them out. And if you are out in the country, what can somebody who doesn't have access to fresh food do? Because fresh food keeps you in better shape all the way around, you know, weight-wise, heart-wise, and everything else. So there's so many things that go into making a patient healthy. And I just think we don't have time to have those discussions. I mean, most folks, again, if you're in one of these systems or you're really tied to the insurance codes, those CPT codes, and having to say how many codes are there now? Gee, 10,000.
Yes, 1,000.
And, you know, but there isn't a code for just being a good doctor and talking to the patient.
No, there really isn't. I don't even think there's a code for a healthy exam, really. I think you have to have a disease associated with it to get paid. The whole system is not what it says it is. And, you know, we've talked a bit about, we have enough time now to make sure we delve into the independent practice track versus this corporatized mega system. I mean, you just described one of the major things that changed. I think that is the difference between the two, and it's time. I've never sent a patient to an independent doctor who didn't see them themselves and didn't spend the time, especially on the consultation, the first visit, to actually spend 45 minutes, sometimes an hour or more, especially if it's a functional medicine practice. And patients don't even know it. They just feel this is so amazing. They've never even heard of you spending time. First of all, you seeing your patient, which is, I think, unusual now, but that you've actually spent time to talk, to answer questions. It's foreign to them, and it should be the standard. They should know that that's the standard. How do we educate patients to really learn the difference, know the difference between an independent practice and one that's hospital owned?
Boy, that's a really good question. And it's a huge question, because he who has the most money seems to win the day. And independent practice doctors don't have the same kind of megaphone that these health systems. When I look at the morning news, all the advertisers for the news is, you know, X has aspired, whatever, you know, some wonderful name health system is who's funding that news show. You don't see independent practitioner. Of course, they don't have the kind of money to advertise like that. And even associations that help independent practitioners, like the Direct Primary Care has groups, Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, you know, so there's groups that try to foster independent practice, but publicly, it's very difficult to compete with what people see on TV. And a lot of these places are associated with a big medical center. So people think, well, big medical center equals better care. I remember when Dr. Dunphy was the chief of surgery at UCSF, and we would have grand rounds. And in grand rounds, you present an interesting case. And when people would begin the case with, "We were referred this patient from an outside hospital," Dr. Dunphy would get angry and he'd stop the presentation and say, "Outside hospital? Is it outside? Does it not have walls? Does it not have offices?" And would really scold people and say, "One day you will be working at the outside hospital. And you're well-trained, as are the people who work at community hospitals." So there's almost, it was like a pejorative term that a community hospital equals bad doctors. When in fact, what we're seeing now, it's the opposite. And that the community hospitals aren't necessarily the ones that are cranking the patients through. So you've got to look at the whole picture, but I just think it's very hard to get the whole picture out there to the general public.
So from the standpoint of the independent doc, if we can't use the media as our platform, does it just come down to being the best you can be in word of mouth?
Absolutely. And one of my colleagues had started out, she actually used to be a nurse practitioner and then she went to medical school. And she started off with a very small practice and people, it was funny because she said she just even ran into somebody in the store, you know, and said, "Are you Dr. So-and-so?" And said, "I hear you're a real doctor. Can I come to you?" You know, so yes, word of mouth works. And I think for the doctors who want to have practices like that, patience is a virtue, that it will come to you. And just like the old days, that doctors hung up a shingle and waited for people to come. And sometimes you get that patient who knows a gazillion people and talks about their visit. And next thing you know, some of their friends come in and on and on. And that's how practices develop.
And what about joining an association like the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, which started as really the antithesis of the AMA almost, right? It's our mouthpiece as independent doctors and patients.
Well, that's right. And it's the sort of thing where when you, the website is aapsonline.org, and there's a banner for patients and you can click it on and find an independent doctor and find a doctor who's willing to try things and will take the time to discuss your case with you. There's websites called the Self-Pay Patient where various organizations are listed that promote self-pay. And when people think, oh, self-pay, I don't have any money, there's no way to afford that. One of the things you have to remember, and if you ever look at these insurance bills, that an insurance bill might say something was $4,000 and then the insurance will pay $2,000. And so then you have a 20% copay and you think, well, I can never pay $4,000 out of your pocket. Well, guess what? You look at a price list of a cash-based practice and something that was listed as $4,000, and I'm not exaggerating, might be $350. You can really see that with x-rays. And people can say, well, the insurance is paying for it. I don't really have to pay for it. But you do. You have to pay the copay, and the copay is calculated from the high price. So you have to do the math and realize that the math works out. And one of the things that keeps people from doing the math is the fact, again, these insurance products have decreased. The kind of product I used to have was very simple. It had a high deductible and it was major medical. And that's what you need insurance for, is major medical. Nobody, unless you're, you know, Jeff Bezos, could afford to pay a hospital bill out of your own pocket. So you need insurance for that. But paying the doctor, my goodness, the prices that self-pay cash-based practices can be a third of the price of a practice that bills insurance. Why? You don't have a multi-thousand dollar salary to have to pay to a person who sits in the office. And I'm not making this up, sound like Joe Biden. It's not a lie, not a joke. That they're on the phone all day to the insurance company trying to get approvals, pre-authorization, get paid. Sometimes you'll get a check from the insurance company for a big case and it's $8. Well, is it a typo? Why did they only pay you $8? Or why did they not pay you at all? You know, I've had done cases where the surgeon hadn't sent a bill in yet, so I couldn't send a bill if the surgeon didn't send a bill, and then the surgeon forgot, so then I never got paid. You know, all these things go on. Whereas if you're dealing with the doctor directly, that the price is less. And believe me, it's very costly to have office staff. Imagine what you have to do when you have a couple extra people in the office staff. Not only do you have to pay their salary, if you provide health insurance, you're providing that. So imagine if you erase those salaries, how low your prices could be, because you don't have to come up with that extra money. So these are the realities of the situation. And many people who've switched can't believe it, that overall, they end up saving money. It's just finding a product, and I won't always call it insurance because there's health sharing. They say ministries, but they all aren't religious, that will give you the major medical. And so you don't need to buy the day-to-day as an insurance issue. Just pay for it out of pocket.
That's a great point. Let's take our last break because I think this is where the rubber really meets the road for patients to become healthcare consumers, knowledgeable ones. So let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. And before the break, you did a wonderful job of explaining, really trying to jog people to understand, just because you say you have health insurance, does it mean you actually have health care? They are not the same. So you can pay your $2,000 a month or whatever you're paying. I can't tell you how many people have question marks when they have to come out of pocket for their deductible or their coinsurance. They're enraged. They're like, I'm paying all this money, but why do I have to pay more? I'm like, this is what you signed up for. And you talked about the flip side, and I want to give another side, the surgeon side of it. We get pre-certification for everything if we're smart. We get pre-certification for everything that we're going to do so that there's a pre-approval. I cannot tell you how many times it's come back that they just deny it, just out of hand, because they can. Because in that small print, they say having this health insurance doesn't mean you have coverage, right? It's not a level playing field. On the other side of it, they don't have a cost of living increase for what they pay the physician and the person doing the work. That's irrelevant. It's the people on the administrative side that seem to get all of the money. So if I recall, years ago, I did talks where I put out the pie of how much doctors get. It was like 7 cents on the healthcare dollar. Of every dollar, 7 cents is actually paid to the physician. I think it's probably less now, honestly. And I think that's what started the whole movement towards mid-levels and how nurse practitioners and everybody else got involved with the healthcare system. In order to get enough volume, you had to add staff in order to keep your doors open.
Well, that whole thing is fascinating to me, because how can you not be paid even after you gave a got the pre-authorization? But the insurers don't care. They're the boss. I once was doing a series of nerve blocks, and you had to do 10 of them in order for them to work. That was the neurological pathway that you had to do. You were sort of instructing the nerve to be paralyzed and not submit out or emit pain signals. So the insurer said, well, we'll authorize 3. And I sent all the paperwork in, the articles, the protocols. And I said, you have to do 10 in a row and you have to do them every day. If they said, well, if the 3 work, then we'll authorize 3 more. It's like they didn't get it. So what do? I just did the rest of them for free because I felt so bad for the patient. But that's what these insurers do.
Yeah, they do, with abandon. And we haven't even talked about the ERISA plans. So we talked at the beginning of, so far we've been talking about the commercial insurances where employer buys the plan and the employees join the plan. But there are some that the insurance companies administer the plan for the employer. So the employer is basically the holder of the money, and then they contract with an insurance company to administer the plan. Those are the worst plans to work with because they're outside of any oversight. The Department of Labor doesn't have oversight over them. The health commissioner in your state does not have oversight over them. It's amazing. And so you're really, it's like a Wild West. You hope that you're going to get paid, and you can pretty much guarantee if it's a big ticket item, you're not going to see that money. And if you do, you're going to have to fight for it. It could be months. It took me 5 years to get paid for one patient. I mean, it's toxic. And I can understand. It's absolutely for the patient and the doctor. And I can understand to a degree why doctors said I'm done and I'd rather just be salaried and take a job and have a 9-to-5 and know that I'm not going to have to do this anymore. I get it. But the grass isn't greener on the other side, I don't think.
No, but you can certainly see why, and particularly the newbies that, and you know, in my day, people weren't necessarily married during training, but people are married, they have families, they have kids, they need to make a buck. They have student loans of $200,000. They need to get to cracking on that. So they kind of take the easy way out. And, you know, there's a piece of you that can hardly blame them. But then when they're unhappy, what do? A lot of people are making the transition. I mean, the percentage increases year after year of people who are leaving the systems. Even though the numbers look bad, it's like half of doctors belong to one of these systems. But now we're starting to see the attrition rate. And they realize, as you said, the grass is not greener.
Well, you know, from the mindset of being a physician, there can't be anything worse than knowing that you cannot advocate for your patient, that you cannot stand in the brink and help them because you're being handicapped, handcuffed, and they're being handicapped and handcuffed because they can't afford sometimes because the deductible is so high. I chose never to put myself in that position because it's counter to what being a physician's about. It's not what we do, but something has to give because this is not working. I don't think it works for the nursing staff. I don't think it works for anybody who really does healthcare because they want to help people. It's just not aligned with that in any way. And I think they've done a lot the last 10 years or 15 years of making us fight each other for turf. And so I don't think anybody's seen the biggest picture, which is we're all being used to make money for somebody else as a profession. And it's not working. If we need to withdraw our consent from the system and say what we're not going to do instead of, oh, I need this and I'll just buckle down and do it. It's just killing us and it's killing patients. Isn't the suicide rate quite high in the healthcare sector?
Oh, absolutely. And what is it? They did a survey not long ago, and 60% of healthcare professionals, nurses and doctors included, reported depression. And even medical students, they did this huge survey around the world of medical students, and 20% reported they were thinking of quitting. So that something's wrong with this picture. I think there was one girl in my class that left school, but I think she had issues, family issues. Her mother was quite ill and that type thing. But people didn't talk about quitting. They talked about how hard it was, but they didn't talk about quitting.
No. You've just got through it. Actually, I enjoyed medical school. I hate to say it, but we had a group. We studied together. We just had everybody who had a skill. Someone liked to memorize. Somebody liked to look everything up. I mean, everybody had something that they loved to do. So it worked out beautifully from the standpoint of the work. I don't know how we did it really, right? It's 100 hours a week of surgery, residency, rotations, but I wouldn't do it any differently because it gave me the foundation and the mindset and the ability to take it in, but also know my limits. That's the key too, isn't it? knowing what you're not going to do and what you can't handle this much more of X, you pull away from it. But it seems people just, I don't know, buckle down or somehow sublimate it. And it's causing us as a group, healthcare professionals, to no longer be able to be effective in some instances and hurt ourselves. And that's not helping patients.
Well, I think you're right. And there's something you said earlier about dividing us and having turf wars. This isn't the first time this has happened. Way back when Medicare was setting prices for the various specialties and they had these things called RVUs and relative value units. And so that somebody sat down and again, he wasn't a doctor. He was a Harvard academician, sat down and decided what things were worth that doctors did.
So from the standpoint of the medical students and, you know, them being able to cope with all of this uncertainty, I mean, this is a different show, I'm sure, but I'm sure we can get rolling and start the process of starting this question. How can they get themselves out of this system if it's so toxic that they haven't even started practicing medicine yet and they're feeling it? What can educators or physicians in practice do to try to educate them so they know there's a different way?
Well, one of the things I find interesting is there's groups that try. There's the Benjamin Rush Institute, named after the famous Dr. Benjamin Rush, ENT specialist, as it were, like you, Dr. George, but one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And many times they've tried to go to medical school to give talks about independent practice, and they're not allowed. So there's collusion, seems too strong of a word, with it's kind of getting the medical students trained to want to be in a system. And that's fine. Certainly medical schools and these large health systems need somebody to work in them, but I think the alternative needs to be presented. And unless a student has a family member or some mentor, somebody who's in a different system, they may never know. Now, I was very lucky. I went to University of California, San Francisco, and at the time, and I can't say what they have now, we had a class that you had to take before you graduated, and it was the entire quarter, 12 weeks, and it was called Ambulatory and Community Medicine. And the whole point of that was to see outpatients, because when you're in medical school and in training, you're usually in the hospital. So you see all this interesting stuff and weird things that bring people to the hospital. But we were supposed to learn what is everyday, day-to-day practice like. What is it that patients come in the door with? And that really helped people formulate what they wanted to do with their lives. Some people thought, oh, this is really boring. If all I'm ever going to see is a sore throat, I don't want to do that. But it helped weed out specialties for people. People could decide, oh, I don't want to see patients at all. I'll be a pathologist. You know, so that was a good thing. And it's hard to know what the education is doing now. When I look at some of the things in the curriculum, I wonder, would time be better spent doing other things than studying about climate change? I don't know that that's necessarily something that should take up hours and hours in medical school when we have so many other things to learn, including how to be a real doctor in practice.
We have a lot of stuff that we as, you know, Americans, humans, doctors, patients really need to come to terms with. This is not sustainable. Whatever's going on now, it's not conducive to health. It's not sustainable from an economic standpoint either. We were talking about these Medicare, Medicaid situation. And this is not thank goodness I'm not in a position that I'm doing things outside of what I trained for and what I emotionally want to do. But I grieve for my colleagues and for patients who are in the system, don't know that there's a different way and are unable to take a step back. Maybe it's time to just speak your truth, whether you're a doctor or patient. If it doesn't work, you need to move on to something else instead of hoping that things are going to change.
The thing that's interesting, and we were talking about this way back in the beginning, is you need more than one person to speak out, and even more than one group. I'm reminded of the movie Network, where Peter Finch, the newscaster, stands up and says, "I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore." And that's what we have to do, but we have to do it as a group. And that's kind of how they win, because they know people have been separated out and divided out, and how easy it is to get people to kind of get in a spirit of the wrong kind of competition, where you're at each other's throats. And rather than banding together and saying we all have a common goal, what's the common goal? Taking good care of the patient in an efficient manner and in a low cost manner. Reasonable costs. I mean, free, as it turns out, doesn't work. Somehow patients, as silly as this always sounds, they have to have some skin in the game. That's been kind of shown in smoking cessation protocols, that the patients pay up front, because if you don't have any skin in the game, there's no reason not to stop smoking. I mean, and if you knew you wanted your lungs to be better, you would have stopped a long time ago. But part of it is a monetary issue. Pay up front. It's the cost of all those packs of cigarettes. You're going to stick with the protocol. So there is a psychological aspect to having money in the transaction. And all these things have to be looked into. People have to stand up and say, this is how it really is. We're not going to be bullied into submission. But there have to be a lot of people that do it. One voice doesn't work, unfortunately.
Well, hopefully people start looking around and talking with their friends and their loved ones, those who've decided to move out of that system, and to let them know, hey, the grass is greener on this side compared to what you guys are doing. And on that note, the time goes very quickly, but I want to thank you so much again for joining me. How can people listen to your podcast and read what you write?
So you can go to MarilynSingletonMDJD.com and go to AmericaOutloud.news/pulse. And Pulse is a podcast that has five different doctors, and I'm on Mondays, but the podcast is always out there. So take a listen. We do all sorts of things to all sorts of topics. And hopefully you hear enough, everybody who's listening now, you hear Dr. George talk about it, you hear me and some of my colleagues talk about it. You'll realize that there is a better way to get really good medical care.
Thank you so much, Marilyn. It's always an honor and a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk Events.